Thank you. Beautiful song. This morning's reading is Mother, A Cradle to Hold Me by Maya Angelou. It is true I was created in you. It is also true that you were created for me. I owned your voice. It was shaped and tuned to soothe me. Your arms were molded into a cradle to hold me, to rock me. The scent of your body was the air perfumed for me to breathe. Mother, during those early dearest days, I did not dream that you had a large life which included me, for I had a life which was only you. Time passed steadily and drew us apart. I was unwilling. I feared if I let you go, you may leave me eternally. You smiled at my fears, saying I could not stay in your lap forever. You were always the heart of happiness to me, bringing nuggets of glee, sweets of open laughter. During the years when you knew nothing and I knew everything, I loved you still. Condescendingly, of course, from my high perch of teenage wisdom, I grew older and was stunned to find how much knowledge you had gleaned, and so quickly. Mother, I have learned enough now to know I have learned nearly nothing. On this day when mothers are being honored, let me thank you that my selfishness, ignorance, and mockery did not bring you to discard me like a broken doll, which had lost its favor. I thank you that you still find something in me to cherish, to admire, and to love. I thank you, Mother. I love you. Thank you. Good morning. Back in the fall, Reverend Virginia asked me if I would be interested in doing a sermon, and I jumped at the chance. A little bit about me and my place here at UUCMC. In 2002, Tommy Harbison and I, you probably know him as Tom, Tommy and I were married here in this very place under this earth window. Tommy had grown up coming here to UU in Lincroft, and it was the first place of worship that made any sense to me at all. It grappled with issues in a meaningful way. It promoted social justice and action, was filled with members committed to making the world a better, more loving, more peaceful and tolerant and inclusive place. Fast forward a decade later, we moved back to the area and we're raising our two sons. Our oldest son, Cole, was around 4 or 5 years old, and one day we were in his room playing and he asked, "How did people get here on Earth?" I asked him what he thought and listened, but he was really frustrated. He couldn't figure it out. So, as any good UU or UU-to-be, I told him to wait a minute and ran to get my Intro to Human Origins College Anthropology textbook. I flipped through the pages and tried to explain what Professor So-and-so had taught about human evolution. To my secular surprise, Cole slammed the textbook shut and shouted, "No, no, the scientists are lying!" I asked him why he was upset, and he explained, as any 4 or 5-year-old might, that evolution, turning from one animal into another, was simply impossible. I stumbled as I tried to explain the expanse of time to a 5-year-old. Ridiculous, I know. He was sincerely upset that scientists believe that apes evolved into humans. This was a kid who loved and still loves science and nature. When he was 5, he would stop to look at every ant that crossed the sidewalk. Clearly, I, his mother, had failed. I did not have the answers, or at least the right answers, and I had just upset Cole and his place, sense of place in the world. That evening, or soon after, I relayed the incident to Tommy and said, "It's time to start going to UU. They'll have better answers." So here we are. And thankfully, you do. We do. Today's sermon is titled Founding Mothers. In the last week alone, I imagine many of you have heard the phrase "our founders," "our founding fathers," numerous times on the news by politicians, reporters, pundits, particularly when speaking of the current impeachment proceedings. When speaking of our founders, there's an assumption that this refers to white men, perhaps those who wrote the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, our first presidents of the United States. I urge you to think about what such an assumption about our founders means about who we are or think we are as a people, as a nation, from the past into the present. But today I'm not asking you to think about these white founding fathers, but rather of some founding mothers. In this vein, I would like you to think about motherhood beyond the boundaries of biology, beyond the boundaries of gender, and to instead think about mothers as individuals and communities, as people who work together to nurture, to raise, and to care for all of our collective children, our future generations, our nation, and our world. In this way, we are all mothers. We are all foundational in creating what is to come. It is with this then lens that I will turn to the past to consider a few people who helped to birth the nation, whether they did so intentionally or not. When thinking of founding mothers, I imagine that many of you might think of the likes of Abigail Adams, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Ida B. Wells, the list could go on and on. But I only have 20 minutes. So I've selected three women whom you probably know something about but may not have heard their full stories. I will begin with someone familiar. She is most commonly known by the name Pocahontas. As a little girl, her father was chief of an expansive empire, chief of the Powhatan, an indigenous peoples that in the 1600s consisted of 15,000 members spanning a 100-mile radius in the Tidewater region of what was soon to be named Virginia. As the popular story goes, Englishman John Smith arrived in 1607 on the shores of the Chesapeake and established what became the first permanent British settlement in North America, Jamestown. Today, the historic site memorializes Pocahontas and John Smith with statues. The myth that grew out of their shared history often spins a tale of a relatively peaceful or predestined journey where power was transferred from indigenous to European hands. Of course, the real story, the real Pocahontas, was much more complicated. When John Smith arrived in the early 1600s in proximity to a Powhatan settlement, Pocahontas was only around 10 years old. She was one of Chief Powhatan's many children. The chief was a man who had facilitated marriages and alliances between various tribes in the region, ultimately concentrating power into his own and the tribe's hands. The Powhatan traditionally considered women to be life-giving, as they not only gave birth to and raised children, but also cultivated the corn that served as the main source of calories and sustenance for their peoples. The Powhatan was a matrilineal and matrilocal culture, where lineage and land cultivation was traced through a mother's line, and men moved in with their wives' families. John Smith's famous account that suggests that after a violent clash between the English and the Powhatan, that Pocahontas chose him, saved him from being sacrificed and killed by her own people, her own father. However, this was not the full story. About 6 months after Smith and his countrymen had set foot on the shores of the James River, Powhatan warriors captured Smith and two other Englishmen. These two other Englishmen were killed, and Smith was spared. However, scholars believe that Smith's capture and release was part of an elaborate ritual whereby the Powhatan performed their power over the newcomers in the region, showcasing their strength, but balancing this with a gesture of mercy. Such a production forced the newcomers to witness and acknowledge the strength of the Powhatan and gave the native peoples an upper hand in negotiations. Although it is not known why Pocahontas, rather than her peers or siblings, acted to save John Smith, it would not have been unusual, since women in the Powhatan culture had the power to save or condemn captives. It was Powhatan women who chose to send a prisoner to death or adopt him into the tribe. In this case, as with other alliances that had been formed in the past, John Smith was spared. In this case, a young girl of 10 saved the captive, perhaps to symbolize the sheer power of the Powhatan over the newcomers. In fact, Pocahontas did much more than ritually save John Smith. By the age of 11, Pocahontas had made several trips between her own village center and the English settlement. She served as a courier and a translator between the two cultures. She learned English words and taught Smith phrases in the Algonquian language. She was largely liked by the English settlers, described as fun, bossy, more athletic than some of the English boys. She did cartwheels and was sometimes viewed as mischievous, but overall was welcomed into the English village. She also spied on the English. As Smith and Pocahontas exchanged knowledge, the first full sentence that Smith recorded in the Algonquian language was, "How many more English ships were coming?" Just over a year after Smith and his men had arrived in the region, the English faced severe hunger, and this worsened over the next couple of years, so that by the spring of 1610, almost 3 years after having first arrived in the Chesapeake, the survivors planned to leave, to return to England. But then another British ship full of supplies, food, more guns, and more men arrived, enabling the British settlement to survive. In the ensuing years, Pocahontas herself was captured by English settlers, after which she converted to Christianity. At 17, married an Englishman named John Rolfe and bore a son. In 1617, she, her new family, along with a trusted counselor of her father, traveled overseas to London where they met English royalty. During her brief time there, she wore Western dress, attended Shakespearean plays, and appeared assimilated to Anglo-cultural norms. It is difficult to know how much she had transformed or was performing the duties of a chief's recently married daughter, a chief always seeking alliances to empower his peoples. But Pocahontas died not long after having arrived in England. Still, her story and legacy grew. Almost two decades after having landed in what was to become Jamestown, John Smith wrote about and published his experiences as an explorer in the New World, where he characterized Pocahontas as his savior and as a desirable woman. Smith's version of Pocahontas gained new mythological status when Disney reimagined her on screen in the mid-1990s. But such a story is mostly fairy tale. In the early 1600s, Pocahontas was a girl, not a woman. She was born into a powerful family and strong Native American community. Still, hundreds of years later, Pocahontas's fairy tale story has been clung onto and retold by Americans for generations as we seek to rationalize or justify, however wrongly, our place here, as a means of minimizing the devastation, the decimation of peoples and cultures that had thrived on the same land for thousands of years. Yet, Pocahontas was powerful, is powerful. Acknowledging her role as a cultural mediator between two very different cultures, emphasizing her intelligence, bravery, wit, and cunning, as well as her youth, demonstrates the power and strength that young girls and women had and have. The real Pocahontas embodied hope for herself, for her father, for her people, and it is that vibrant life, the independent young girl who did cartwheels, but also asked how many more English would be coming, that should be remembered. Yes, she did marry an Englishman, but she should not be seen as a traitor to her people. She had been captured and was also building alliances. She was not simply a girl won over by the white man's ways, nor was she a pawn of her father's. Her life was too short, but it was full. Ultimately, Pocahontas, both the real girl and young woman, as well as the myth that has grown around her, helped found who we are as a nation, who we have become, for better or worse. Another figure from the American past that has name recognition and has impacted who we are, but has largely been misunderstood, is Sally Hemings. Born almost two centuries after, but in a place not far from where Pocahontas did cartwheels, Sally was born into a much different time, culture, and peoples. The American Revolution was beginning, and she was to become intimately tied to one of the future's biggest revolutionaries. I teach U.S. women's history at Rutgers, and one of my favorite class sessions is about Sally Hemings. Students read an article called The Hemings-Jefferson Treaty. Its author, historian Annette Gordon Reed, proves what she already knew, but what many had denied, that Thomas Jefferson's descendants included both the so-called white descendants of he and his wife, Martha Wales, as well as the African-American descendants of the enslaved Sally Hemings. The Hemings-Jefferson Treaty itself refers to the agreement made between then 16-year-old Sally Hemings and 45-ish-year-old Thomas Jefferson. It was 1789, and at 16, Sally had lived as a slave in Paris alongside Jefferson and his two daughters for a couple of years when Sally realized she was pregnant. 16-year-old Sally Hemings was enslaved, but while living in Paris, she had earned wages for her work, worn fine silken dresses to elite parties, and witnessed the free black community living there. She also likely knew that she could sue Jefferson in maritime court for her freedom, as others had done, not Jefferson, but other men, but she was only 16. Although her brother, James, also enslaved, was in Paris as well, Sally missed her mother, her sister, the rolling hills of Virginia, all that was familiar to her, and she was pregnant, in a time when having a child was much riskier than today, and she was pregnant with Thomas Jefferson's child. He wanted her to return to Monticello with him, the estate he had designed and which was built by enslaved peoples, the place which had been her home. According to historian Gordon Reed, Sally made a deal with Jefferson. If she were to return to Virginia with Jefferson, their children would be freed in adulthood. Jefferson took the deal, and in 1789, they and Jefferson's two white daughters began the journey back home. Prior to reaching Monticello, however, Sally had a miscarriage, but the deal was in place for their future children as well. Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had four children who lived to adulthood. Three of these four children passed as white. Like Sally Hemings herself, they were fair-skinned and living at a time and place where people were shackled, beaten, raped, abused, bought and sold, fully dehumanized, in other words, enslaved, due to the color of their skin. Thus, it is not surprising that those who could pass for white did. One of Hemings and Jefferson's children, however, did not. He was named James Madison Hemings and known as Madison. Madison grew up at Monticello with his mother and siblings. They lived in special quarters in the estate, though Madison and his siblings did not receive much affection or notice from his father. Per the Hemings-Jefferson Treaty, Madison was freed in 1826 via his father's will and remained close to his mother until her death almost a decade later. He then moved to Ohio and worked as a carpenter, settled down with a wife and children, and decades later published his family's story, the Hemings-Jefferson story, in an 1873 Ohio newspaper. Within days of the story's publication, Madison's motives were questioned and the account delegitimized by those who did not want to believe. Still, during Sally Hemings' lifetime, rumors had abounded about her and her rumored relationship with Thomas Jefferson. In 1802, for example, songs, poems, popular rhymes, and newspaper stanzas, some more tasteful than others, were written about Monticellan Sally. Thus, the public knew or at least gossiped about the intimate relations between the then newly minted President Thomas Jefferson and the enslaved Sally Hemings. Today, being able to fully comprehend Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson's relationship is difficult, perhaps impossible. Theirs was one absent or void of consent, burdened by centuries of slavery and all that came with it. Sally Hemings was the enslaved property of Thomas Jefferson. She was 30 years younger than he. He was on his way to becoming vice president and then president of the United States of America. The imbalance of power between these two people is hard to overstate. Making it even more complex, Sally Hemings was also Thomas Jefferson's first wife's half-sister. Got that? Sally's mother, Elizabeth Hemings, was enslaved. Sally's biological father was her mother's master, John Wales, who was also father to Martha Wales, Thomas Jefferson's deceased wife. I usually have in class a family tree, which is a great discussion. Over a century before Hemings' lifetime, a Virginia statute declared, quote, all children born in this country shall be held bond or free only according to the condition of the mother, end quote. This 1662 law made official what had then become common practice in the colony of Virginia. Motherhood determined a baby's status as free or enslaved. In a patriarchal society built on the evidence of slavery, it largely went unquestioned when slave-owning masters raped enslaved girls or women. Although a family Bible of a slave-owning family might only name white descendants, a separate list of estate holdings might then name enslaved people as property. Such records were deemed separate, unrelated to one another, the first designating family, the second listing property. Such records further instilled the notion held by a slaveholding society that some humans were worthy of family and others were not even seen as human. In fact, there are still some scholars and some white descendants of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, or Thomas Jefferson and Martha, who refuse to acknowledge the third U.S. president's relations with Sally Hemings. DNA evidence has confirmed the oral histories that had passed down stories over generations about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Some Hemings descendants are convinced that their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother had something of a loving relationship with Jefferson. Other descendants have a less rosy picture of their grandmother's circumstances, a young enslaved woman who gave birth to her master's children. Still, whatever their relationship, one of Jefferson's descendants living today has argued that Sally Hemings should be considered one of the country's founding mothers. that she should be memorialized alongside Thomas Jefferson, that she too helped to build a foundation for what this country was to become. Especially if historian Annette Gordon Reed is right and Sally Hemings did negotiate freedom for her children with Thomas Jefferson at a time when such an agreement would have been deemed impossible, then what else was she capable of? What power did she and other enslaved women claim, even demand from powerful men? Historians have proven that enslaved men, women, and children regularly resisted their enslavement in big and small ways. One of these ways was in building community and family, despite the odds. Sally Hemings is part of this history. She is part of this resistance, and she is integral to the story of freedom, an ideal that most Americans today, regardless of political orientation, hold on to and celebrate. Sally Hemings is one of our founding mothers. And finally, I would like to very briefly discuss one more founding mother, Lucretia Mott. A quick summation of Lucretia Mott and her place in the world. She was a badass. Born a Quaker in Massachusetts in 1793, Lucretia developed a strong sense of equality between the sexes and races at a young age. In marriage, she defied common norms, lived outside the bounds of being a good wife, spoke her mind in public, and threw her heart and soul into the abolitionist movement. Like most of her contemporary women's rights activists, she began her advocacy work in this anti-slavery movement. But she did not stop here. She was radical, among the most radical of a radical sect of Quakers. And these Quakers were immersed in efforts to end slavery, advance the rights of free blacks and American Indians, protest war, protect immigrant workers, and secure property and divorce rights for women, et cetera, et cetera. Mott believed in seeking a larger liberty. This meant truly transforming society, rooting out oppression in all its forms, in the family, the church, the community, the economy, the polity, all simultaneously. Mott had met Elizabeth Cady Stanton at the 1840 anti-slavery convention in London, and the two women bonded over their mutual exclusion from the male meeting, male-dominated meeting. 8 years later, Lucretia Mott's name was used as the headliner to attract women's rights reformers to Seneca Falls, New York. Here, Lucretia was among 300 radical women and men who gathered to debate and edit Elizabeth Cady Stanton's Declaration of Sentiments, which boldly stated, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." For Mott, this meeting was significant, but only part of a broader radical vision that many of us in this room share today, a belief in larger liberty, a commitment to transforming ourselves, transforming community, and transforming the world, to root out oppression in all its forms. Lucretia Mott was one of many of our nation's founding mothers. She fought for and helped build a stronger, more egalitarian, more hopeful world. Slide here. It'll go eventually. Oh, there it goes. This past summer, our family made a point of stopping at Seneca Falls and visiting the Women's Rights National Historical Park. Though we breezed through the exhibits, we breathed in its hope. My daughter Alice was drawn to the bronze statues of radical reformers that included several founding mothers and fathers of our nation who shared a vision for a more just world and had gathered at Seneca Falls in 1848. It is for Alice and my sons, Benjamin and Cole, that I strive to be a radical mother who continues the work of these founding mothers who built alliances, fought for freedom, and reached for a larger liberty. Please join me as we all continue the work of building a larger liberty, rooting out oppression in all of its forms, and realizing the vision of our founding mothers.